we'll go ahead. Yeah, we probably should go ahead and get started. Thanks everyone for coming to this really, really exciting session today. We've got some great speakers and great topics. excuse me. First up for our Voices of the Century is we're going to have Warren Shirk and Teague Schneider here from the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences. They're going to talk first, and they're going to talk kind of tag team and present together. So. Okay. So, along with Teague, we have Warren Shirk. Warren is manager of special collections at the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences, the Margaret Herrick Library in Beverly Hills, California. I am going to just turn it over to you then. Okay. So. Join me in welcoming. They've got it all covered, so they don't need me. thank you very much. And we're going to, let's see. Is this an okay place? I think so, yeah. All right. Preserving and disseminating film voices.
Okay, hi. Thanks for coming. My name's Teague Schneider. I'm going to introduce myself today, and Warren. And I'm the manager of Oral Histories Projects at the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences. It's a new position, only 6 months old, so I'm only 6 months in. And Warren here is manager of Special Collections at the Margaret Herrick Library. I'm part of an interdepartmental initiative that's supposed to pull collections together from across different dispersed collections across the Academy, and Warren has been here for 29 years, so he's a veteran. But we're the two key staff tasked with preserving our audio oral history collection, which you'll see has a very long legacy. And we represent the kind of more the smaller contingent of privately funded collecting institutions for audio holdings. What?
There is it.
Okay. The Academy Oral History Program has been documenting the lives and careers of individuals who have worked in diverse areas of the motion picture industry. We're going to take you on a little behind-the-scenes look at our project and content, discussing our preservation plans, collection development, and changes in production and access strategies that we're trying to implement. Since the early 90s, the interviews have been conducted largely by staff members of the Academy's Margaret Herrick Library and Science and Technology Council on topics ranging from art direction and film editing to machinery to censorship and experimental film. Due to his veteran status, though, Warren's going to tell you a little bit more about the history of the program.
The Margaret Herrick Library is the preeminent cinema research facility housing our core collection, special collections, a photograph and graphic arts archive. All of our sound recordings in the form of discs and tapes are held and administered by special collections. A complete list of our oral histories can be found on oscars.org. On this site, you can see descriptions of each interview and access a few audio samples. Our traditional process has been multi-session career-length interviews with one oral historian where they ask the subject research-based questions. As is customary in a written oral history workflow, the audio is transcribed, the transcription fact-checked, then reviewed by the subject. The interviewer writes an introduction, selects photographs, proofreads the text, and prepares an index. The book is printed and bound. The bound volumes are shelved in the library reading room for access or use by Academy members, researchers, and students. Another end product created by the oral historians are indexes that are available on-site via our library portal. To be relevant to today's location, we found some of the content we're going to highlight by typing the keyword Kansas City into the searchable oral history index, which performs a search across oral history indexes, and you can see we got three different oral histories that had some mention of Kansas City, and we're going to play an excerpt of one of those. As for the audio cassette masters, they are stored at our Pickford Center facility in Hollywood in the library vault alongside Academy Film Archive film and video vaults. We're currently housing over 18 hours of interview material.
1,800.
1,800 hours.
But we may only migrate 18 this year. We'll see.
Good thing she's up here. The tapes are inventoried with the rest of our recordings in the InMagic database. After access copies are made, audio cassette masters are placed in archival boxes and placed in storage. The used copies for transcription and research access are stored in the library's Fairbanks Center in Beverly Hills. They are consulted and used by Academy staff when requested for documentaries, programming, and for Oscars.org. In the 1990s, open reel preservation masters from the cassette masters were made. The services were donated by Hollywood sound vendor Todd A.O. Transferring using Dolby A did cut down on the noise, but from a recapturing standpoint, this puts us in a position where we have to consider the eight Dolby A decoders for playback. So for future preservation planning, we'll have to decide which elements we should use for our source material for our digital migration.
So as digital preservation and web access planning has just begun, as we're just starting out with our new initiatives, we thought this was a good chance to take you through some of our content. And by the way, all the images that you're going to see are from our library collections, and we think that they really work to enrich our oral history collection, and we're experimenting with that.
The Academy's first ever oral histories were actually recorded in 1948 by Howard Walls, the Academy's first film curator, and here's some publicity from the time. As many oral history recordings come about, and luckily for us, one individual took the initiative and recorded the stories of several silent filmmakers. Though short-lived, Walls called the program Voice Recordings of Film Pioneers. All of these histories were recorded on sound mirror, open reel, paper-based tape recorded at 7.5 inches per second. They were also part of the open reel preservation effort that we endeavored in the early 1990s. J. Cyril Dolly was a pioneering American director and died within a year of his interview. As you can imagine, audio interviews with silent film professionals are incredibly rare. In this excerpt, Dolly recalls the premiere of the film Snow White in Kansas City in 1916 at a special movie party sponsored by the Kansas City Star.
Mark entered the film field in 1915 and soon hit the top notch. I directed her for the next 3 years and made 1850 feature pictures with her. Miss Clark was only 5 feet tall and weighed about 100 pounds. But what a lovely dainty figure and what a personality. Once she said to me, "Mr. Dolly, don't ever worry about keeping me waiting for scenes. Don't forget that I am considering myself just a working girl. My hours are from 9:30 to 4:30. At that time, she was making an income of $1 million a year. In the midst of my career with Clark, we made Winsome's Ames Snow White. It was for Christmas release, and it was played to the largest audience ever assembled under one roof and viewing one picture at the same time. The audience numbered 18,000 people. It was in Kansas City Auditorium, Convention Auditorium, a circular building with a picture screen in the center. The screen was four square. They projected the picture from four angles, from four projecting machines in the side of the room, so that the entire audience could see the picture at the same time. Years later, when Walt Disney made his famous cartoon picture of Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, I wrote him a letter of congratulations. He replied to thank me and stated that when Miss Clark's picture of Snow White was shown in Kansas City, I was in the audience, just one of the crowd jammed in the top gallery watching the screen, just a wide-eyed spectator. But that picture gave me the inspiration for my cartoon years later, and for which I sincerely thank you."
So This kind of marrying of photo, manuscript, and clipping file collections with the oral history audio is something we're experimenting with, and we think it's a way of expanding interest and access to our audio holdings.
Now I'm going to go through some of the highlights to show the diversity represented in our oral history program, which began recording histories in 1992.
And this is the program proper, before it was sort of a small effort in the 1940s.
The photo shown is from our film production files. We pulled it because an oral history with costume designer Adele Balkan, pictured here on the left, designing for Julie Andrews. Balkan discusses this film and her work on such films as Notorious and The Ten Commandments. We have a history of Disney animator Mark Davis. Beginning in the 1930s, Mark was a vital member of the core production team for Disney features from Snow White to 101 Dalmatians. Seen here, Davis is at work on Sleeping Beauty in 1959. In his history, cinematographer William Fraker recounts his four-decade career, including acclaimed work on Rosemary's Baby and Bullet, and his rewarding collaborations with various directors. Director, producer, and avant-garde filmmaker Curtis Harrington details his multifaceted filmmaking career in and out of Hollywood. Carl Malden, best known for his role in Streetcar Named Desire, recalls his career in theater and television. From 1989 to 1992, Malden was president of the Academy and discusses his leadership role.
He looks like a leader.
Composer Hans J. Salter, who was responsible for the sound of universal horror films such as The Creature from the Black Lagoon, recollects conducting in movie theaters in Vienna and Berlin in the early sound years when he was composing and compiling music at UFA. I conducted an oral history with Mr. Salter in 1994 when he was 98 years old.
Oh, young Warren.
Eugene Zukor, the son of motion picture pioneer and Paramount founder Adolf Zukor, was affiliated with Paramount Pictures for 40 years beginning in 1915 when he went to work in the studio publicity department. We're going to show a clip from Zukor's oral history about his first trip to Kansas City in 1919. At the time of this recording, in 1992 and 93, he was in his mid-90s.
At Kansas City, the theater was owned by Frank Newman, not a syndicate, not part of First National. He owned a theater, he probably built it. It was a beautiful theater in Kansas City. He wanted Paramount product, so he came to New York and he's got this beautiful house, and he would like to make a deal that they would have the exclusive showings of first run Paramount Pictures. I was working at the Paramount Exchange at that time in New York. And the bankers who had approved the issuance of the preferred stock did so with a provision that they would appoint a treasurer or the equivalent who would sit on the money and deal it out according to the values that they thought were obtainable or should be obtainable. But he was their man who would supervise this.
Who was that?
And his name was H.D.H. Connick. So I went into Connick's office and he explained to me that he was not there to oust my father, that the bankers were not going to move in there, but the bankers were in there to rebuild and reconstruct Paramount and make it a power in the field of exhibition. And they had in mind at that moment two enterprises. One was Newman's Theater in Kansas City, Missouri. The other was a theater in Denver, Colorado. They said, I would like to send you out to Kansas City and Denver and look over those two theaters with a view of purchasing them. So incidentally, I had met my wife, who was a 15-year-old girl back in 1915, and who has since moved from Denver to Kansas City. Uh-huh. And I saw it as a dual opportunity that if I could get the job to go to Kansas City, I would have a chance to see her. I hadn't seen her since we met 5 years before. So I didn't tell him this. So I sent Emmy a letter to the effect that I was being designated Paramount's representative in Kansas City, and I would like to meet her. So that was the beginning of our romance. If not for that, I never would have seen her. And so I went out there with the attorney, and we went to Kansas City first. And I met her, and we fell for each other immediately. I said I would go up to Denver to close the deal in Denver, and then I would come back to Kansas City, and we get down to discuss our relationship. It wouldn't have happened if I hadn't met Connick. Because there was no way in the world that a film salesman out of New York would have been sent to Kansas City. And subsequently, when the deal for financing was floated, one of the first things the financial people approved of was to acquire these independent theaters.
A little bit of Kansas City history there. Now we're going to move on to some new directions. Besides the open reel preservations that were made in the 90s, since 2007 we've been digitizing on demand for researchers for access only.
And instead of digitization on demand, we're now looking at doing large-scale preservation quality digital migration of all of our material. Similar to other institutions whose programs started in the latter half of the 20th century, oral history audio has been used primarily as reference material, but the Academy's new mandate, like many others, is to treat the audio as the primary source so that audiences can hear the voices of the film pioneers. The Academy Film Archive, of which I'm sort of affiliated with, I'm affiliated with the library and the Film Archive, and we're now shooting video oral histories. The Film Archive has begun a partnership with the University of Southern California's Digital Repository, and is currently migrating all of its legacy video collections, 3/4-inch U-matic and other obsolete formats, being first in the queue. And so on the audio side, we're trying to get a piece of this and coming up with new workflows to catalog the over 1,800 hours of audio material that we have in our collection. And we hope to migrate it all en masse with USC. So for those that aren't aware, USCDR is a new repository option being made available, and they're very cheap, by the way, through the USC Library and adapting the Shoah Foundation digital archive infrastructure. So it's very appropriate for audio and video oral history collections and other media collections of specific research interest to USC libraries. Because of their cinematic arts program, fortunately for us, they're very interested in these kind of collections. So it's also a very exciting time for the Academy because we're also in the very early planning stages of an organization-wide digital asset management system revamp. In fact, this will actually be the first time that the Academy's many collecting bodies will be attempting to feed data all into a centralized repository, which changes things substantially, as you might imagine. And generally across the Academy, we're looking at a lot of new outreach initiatives directed at increasing collaboration so that we can reach out to new and wider audiences and also just make use of our resources. So these are some of the partners that you're looking at for our new oral history initiative. The Oral History Project is sort of nestled within this culture change I'm describing, and it's the reason why I came and didn't just have Warren present. It's taking its new form, working with contributors and collaborators across the organization and outside. So I've been working on forming partnerships across Hollywood to collectively develop a strategy to best document and preserve our history through our voices or through professionals' voices. The reason for these partnerships is based on two main problems that we've identified. The first of which is that many institutions were creating histories on audio and video, but did not have adequate funding, facilities, archival infrastructure, storage, archival staff, especially those with audiovisual training. A lot of the guilds are starting to get an archivist for the first time, but a lot of times, you know, they're overloaded and inundated with decades worth of archival material that they've amassed just by being the default archive for their members. And then number two was that there was no overall strategy for recording oral histories to avoid duplication of effort and to also identify priority subjects. So, you know, what professions have been completely left out? Do we have no costume designers? Do we need to interview someone that's gotten 17 Academy Awards and they've never been interviewed, that kind of thing? So now with the partners we have, including the Writers Guild Foundation, I'm sure you've had plenty of time to read this, but the Writers Guild Foundation, the Art Directors Guild, the Editors Guild, the Screen Actors Guild, and the International Cinematographers Guild, among others, such as the Visual Effects Society and the Film Music Foundation. We're working collectively to come up with what's been done and what needs to be done. So we're strategizing preservation and access needs of audio and video oral history collections, but also sharing resources to co-produce oral histories. Together we're coming up with cost and resource sharing models, as well as shared standards such as profession-specific templated questions, so we don't have to reinvent the wheel every time we do an interview, as well as down the road, we're working on creating a shared controlled vocabulary. So I know this is an audio conference, but I'm going to show you a short clip from our recent video oral history with Michael Apted. Who's familiar with Michael Apted? Okay. Creator of the Up series, sometimes we don't know if we're the only ones that know about this stuff, which was strategically topical in that we knew that the DGA, the Directors Guild of America, had interviewed him about his feature career, but hadn't gone into depth about his doc career. So we did 3 hours with him just talking about docs, which was fantastic. This is just a highlight, and it's short. You need to turn up the audio.
In a society where we've lost faith in the press, you know, we've lost faith in television news. You know, the best reporting is probably in documentaries now. You know, and the society we're living in and the political world we're living in, you know, we're losing our voice. And documentaries is one way that people can express their voice. So I think it's a very powerful machinery for the expression of public opinion, you know, and now more than ever we need in this weird society, the Twitter society we lead in, you know, where what is freedom and who knows what about everybody and all this sort of stuff, and people seem neutral about politics. I think the documentary is a very valuable piece of, you know, equipment for the modern person to know about and to have and to watch and to, you know, recognize. And
you're a very valuable part of that community and a wonderful gentleman.
That was the end of the interview. In addition to the new initiatives, larger picture, the Academy is currently fundraising. We're in the fundraising phase for the creation of a motion picture museum, slated to open in 2017 to be located on the Los Angeles County Museum of Art campus. The historic May Company building is currently in plans for being retrofitted, preserved, and remodeled to house the Academy's museum devoted to the art, science, and craft of motion pictures. The museum will contain over 290,000 square feet of state-of-the-art galleries, exhibition spaces, movie theaters, educational areas, and special event spaces. It will be devoted to exploring and curating the history and future of the moving image. So, of course, the Academy's permanent collection, including audio and visual video oral histories, will help to, and the growing collection that we're acquiring through doing outreach and making connections with so many of these collections that don't have care. It will help to inspire and shape future collections for the museum. And this is kind of a silly image, but we don't have a curator yet, so we don't have fancy mock-ups. But the opening of the museum has already challenging collection staff to think of new innovative ways of making collections accessible, like that which Warren has done by marrying the legacy oral history sound recordings with images from our library collections. All of the excerpts that you've heard or will hear are the kind of content that would be appropriate for like touchscreen consoles for museum goers to just peruse through with keywords. So, one more.
Of course, I've heard Barbara Streisand many times before that, I heard recordings of her, and I heard her on radio, of course, and I knew she had a really magnificent voice and terrific range. But at the same time, I had also heard through a lot of dialogue from other sources that she'd had a lot of trouble in, I think it was Goldwyn Studios, where she had made a picture prior to the one that she made at the 20th Century. And they just arbitrarily put up a microphone, the same microphone that they use on all of their vocals. And she didn't like that at all. In other words, they didn't consider her an artist in her own right. So I had heard about that. So when she came in, she happened to walk into the re-recording room, and I introduced myself to her, and I said, honey, if you don't mind, as soon as you sort of get settled around here, if you don't mind, I'd like to make a test with you just singing a little bit, and I'm going to put up some microphones, and I want to see which microphone is best suited for your voice. So she was perfectly willing to make the test, so I had 9 microphones. After I had every microphone that was available, and I said, well, now here, honey, here's a whole bank of microphones. And at that time she said, oh, I see you have a Neumann. I said, yeah, I think it's a very good microphone. And I said, I have another microphone that which you may like too, which is called an AKG, which kind of embellishes the lower tones a little bit. So I want you to listen to that as well. And I can actually AB, which means I can make a comparison between the two at the same time and switch from one to the other and let you hear the difference in the qualities of the two. Well, of course, she was delighted, and she selected the Neumann and the AKG, the two microphones, which I felt pretty confident that she would select.
Now, you say that the AKG microphone would enhance the lower range of the voice. What did you hear in her voice?
Well, it made it a little bit richer. You say it gave it just a bit more body. You see, the Neumann had a very good range, but the AKG emphasized the lower octave a little bit better than the AKG. So I recorded her on both of those microphones at the same time. So she had a choice because, you see, her vocals, some of them were pitched in a high register and some of them were pitched in a lower register. So as it turned out, she would select the AKG for the lower tones where she didn't have to go up very high, and she'd select the Neumann where her range was primarily in the upper octave. So you could have your cake and eat it.
Making me recall.
So hearing what goes on behind the scenes in many cases may shed light on such things as the mystery of why Oscars are awarded to certain individuals when they're often based on a specific or creative technical contribution, which is why I really like this clip, because people often don't realize that the technical craft people that get Academy Awards in the sound categories and in other and all the other behind the scenes, the costume design and all the other categories, are often selected by their peers for the Academy Award because of something they did on the film that that people in Hollywood know about, but when you see the Academy Awards and you just get an Oscar for sound, the greater world doesn't always realize that. It's actually based a lot of times on some specific creative or technical innovation on the film. And oral history is one of the ways that we can find that out and let people know. Motion picture craft oral histories are also important documents that help trace the ever-shifting history of technology, which a lot of our oral histories cover.
So we'll end with the most recent architectural rendering of the museum to be, and we have postcards also if you want them. They're out there.
On the table out there.
I think the futuristic sphere married with the historic building facade that you see on that side, by the way, there's going to be a 1,000-seat theater in the sphere, I guess. It all just seems very sci-fi to us, but it's sort of serving to us as like a visual inspiration of how we, the collection staff, need to bring the past into the future. So we hope to see you in Los Angeles in 2017. Thank you.
Thank you.